Hello, this is Outlook, the programme that tours the world through incredible true life stories. I'm Emily Webb. When the movie Lion was released in 2016, people were astonished by the tale of Saroo Brawley tracking down his birth family in India after nearly two decades by using Google Earth. It was nominated for six Oscars and also shone a light on Saroo's adoptive family in Australia.
I sort of tend to think of my life in stages, like before and then after. So it's very different now.
Sue Brawley is Saroo's adoptive mum, and today we're hearing the family's astonishing story from her perspective. For Sue, that starts way back, in a small, isolated house on the Australian island of Tasmania in the 1950s. Sue's parents had recently arrived in the country after fleeing Hungary and Poland in the aftermath of World War II. Sue had two sisters, and her father ran a car wrecking business on the farmland outside the family home. But the successive failure of his business ideas left the family in increasing poverty.
Environmentally, it was just a magical spot for little girls growing up. But very quickly, and within a matter of years, it became the most horrific and just ghastly junkyard, covered over by rusting hulks of vehicles. Also, a huge accumulation of building materials that my father had been scrounging all around the place with the view to building a house, a bigger house, for by now, of course, there's three children in the family. But we never got an adequate house built, and we were struggling to even just keep a roof over our heads.
What was it like inside the house? How was family life?
The family life was traumatic, because at the end of the day, my parents never really recovered from the traumas they had endured prior to leaving their homelands. So they came to parenting in a very dysfunctional way, and it soon became evident that they really weren't getting on well as a couple. You know, in the end, when there's no healthy interaction, humans go down to the lowest form of interaction, and that is violence.
Sue says that she saw their father brutally beat their mum, and when she and her sisters would try to intervene, they'd be subjected to physical abuse themselves. Sue would try to get help from adults outside the home, a priest and the local police, but no one would get involved in what they saw as a family matter.
It's a horrific place to be in. For isolated and young children, seeing this, hearing it particularly, is just an absolute nightmare, because you just can't avoid it. We were confined in this tiny little house, you know, just three rooms, and it was just a nightmare. Even though you can tolerate it and you're there and you survive it, it's an experience that precludes joy and happiness.
How did your mother seem to cope with life at home?
Well, she just kept on pushing on. It was just what you did each day, and it was the same the next day. And it was just so terrible to watch, because she just had this absolute belief that she would not survive if she left that situation. She was too afraid to hardly raise her voice, and she was not available. She wasn't there as a mother to teach three daughters what they needed to know to get on in life.
So you started to form this vision of how you wanted your future to look, and it was obviously very different from your past. When you met your husband, John, how did he fit into that?
Well, in a lot of ways, he was the key to take me to that new place. Just the fact of acceptance, and also safety and calmness, a feeling of respect. There was no fear.
Because you got married when you were, what, 17? How different was your life after you got married?
Oh, it was bliss. We were very free to just make our own pathway. We had weekends free. So mostly we went off in the car. John loves surfing and the beach, and we took to camping and our connection with the outdoors and nature was also very restorative for me and gave me a chance to recover and become positive about the future.
And one of the things that you and John agreed on was adoption. Why did you want to adopt a child, do you think?
It was just a joint belief in the fact that this would be a good thing to do for our world. Seeing on TV vision of other parts of the world that were struggling so much with the fact of overpopulation, particularly the famines that we saw, those sorts of images really rocked me. And then also another thing was coming into our world, and that was a recognition of how fragile our planet is. I was learning about that at school, and I, deep down in me, was thinking, hey, a lot of this is down to the fact that there's just too many of us, we people, are doing this. So I guess in a simple way I thought, look, we can do something a bit different.
Mm-hmm. What sort of mother did you want to be?
I wanted to be a perfect mother, and I was determined to make every effort to make sure I was the best I could be. I wasn't going to be a mother that just happened. There was no accident going to happen to me, and I was going to educate myself about the requirements of being a good mother. And I certainly wasn't going to undertake it unless I had adequate resources to do so that would be for the best for my child. So it was a very considered decision to be a parent in the first place.
You did receive quite a lot of judgment from other people in the intervening years when you and your husband weren't having children.
It sort of began, oh, look, you know, you've got your house, you're all set up, now you start having children. And then after a while, when it's not happening, everyone starts wondering why. And because we were so private about our beliefs, in the end, people began to think, oh, isn't it sad? They obviously can't have children, otherwise they would have.
How long was it until you were actually able to apply to adopt a child?
It took 16 years. Every country has their own situation regarding adoption as far as laws go, requirements. It's just such a minefield in every country. And then out of the blue, the law changed and we could apply.
So tell me about this. When did you first hear the name Saru?
Well, that was certainly an incredible moment. Quite quickly, suddenly we got a phone call saying, we have got a file here of a child about 5 years of age that might be suitable for your family, and his name is Saru. Well, you know, we just thought, well, the heavens are with us. It was just such a gift. And as soon as we could, really within hours, we were in the department office looking at this little passport photo of this tiny little boy with big brown eyes. And he just was born for us at that moment.
Did you feel that instant connection? Were even just seeing the photo?
Definitely. I suppose some people might say it's like when you give birth to a child and you see your little baby there and its little tiny face. Well, for most people, instantly, that's a connection. And for us, that connection was formed with that little photo.
What were you told about Saru and why it was he was up for adoption?
Well, the file basically said that he had been found on the streets near the Howrah railway station, which is the main railway station in Calcutta as it was known then. And so the police had taken him to a government-run institution for a few weeks. And at that time, while he was there, a woman who ran a foundling home visited this government institution and spoke to him. And for the first time, really, he was speaking with someone that spoke Hindi. That's his first language. Whereas in Calcutta, everyone predominantly speaks Bengali. And so the communication for him was very difficult, and no one really knew why he was there, where he'd come from. So he was taken back to the foundling home and the process began of trying to find where he'd come from and maybe to find his family.
Mm-hmm. Because what did he tell her about his background, about how it was he'd ended up at this railway station in Kolkata?
He said he was lost, that somehow he'd got on a train and just ended up at this station. He got off and he didn't know where he was anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So over the coming days, he in fact did get on and off various trains, but he never seemed to be able to get on a train that took him back to where he came from. So he explained all of this and the workers tried to figure this out. He gave a little description of where he came from. But at the end of the day, he was a little boy that had very poor language skills anyway. He wasn't educated. He certainly didn't know the name of where he came from, which station.
So they didn't have any luck in finding out where he was from or tracking down his family. And so the adoption proceeded. It took 8 months to arrange everything. At the end of that 8 months, when he arrived at the airport and you were waiting there for him, what are your memories of that day?
It was a little miracle in my life because, you know, the door opened and the children filed out. There was more children than just Saru alone. But in fact, strangely, we weren't really aware of the other couples that were welcoming their children because he just suddenly came through the door. And, of course, we recognised him straight away from this photo. And really, time stood still. And, of course, by that time, we were just in such an excited state. But we were also very mindful of the fact that we had to come over as calm and in control so that we didn't frighten our new son. And that was always uppermost in our mind, that we couldn't, you know, sort of jump up and down and scream and cry and carry on with excitement. We had to be utterly calm. He was brought over to us by the escort and we had a little shaking of hands and a sort of little half hug. And, you know, he seemed also very calm. But, of course, his mind must have been in a huge whirl. It was, you know, certainly something I'd never forget, just one of those most precious moments in your life.
Tell me about the T-shirt he was wearing.
Well, of course, we'd sent over clothing and we had a rather tongue-in-cheek T-shirt which portrayed Tasmania as the larger island rather than Australia proper. And so, of course, it had Tasmania written on it and he just had his little shorts on as well and this Tasmania T-shirt, so there was no room for error. He was ours.
In those first weeks and months he was with you, how did you all adjust?
It was remarkably normal and natural. And that was vital to me in many ways because obviously Saru hadn't come to us via the normal birthing process. But in a way, once he was here with us and we just jumped straight into being mum and dad and parents, even if we couldn't communicate with words, all of the automatic things just seemed to flow along so easily.
Mm-hmm.
We were truly very fortunate because as time went on and years passed, of course, we didn't have such a calm and easy run with our second son.
When Saru first arrived, his English wasn't very good. As it began to improve, he told you a little more about what had happened to him, the circumstances around him showing up at this train station in Kolkata. What did he tell you? And I'm thinking particularly about his brother in this as well.
Well, of course, a lot of those things were quite challenging for him to talk about because they were traumatic. So we did not drill him and question him intensely to get information. This had to be something that he had to share with us when he was ready. And at the end of the day, he was with us, he was our son. It really didn't make a huge difference to our parenting style, how we were going to handle issues that came up. We just were happy when they became evident. So as his language improved, he would start telling us things, and that's when I was also very carefully writing all of this information down in the form of my diaries. So just bit by bit, all of the story of his first 5 years was disclosed to us. His prime thought at that time was about his elder brother, who he spent quite a bit of time with and had been with on the evening that he actually got lost. So he knew that his brother would have been in a most distraught place. I mean, losing your little brother forever, it's just a concept that's hard to get your head around. So Saru believed that his brother would have been desperately searching for him. We could see that this was a real worry, a constant thing that played on his mind. And, you know, I knew that he was having difficulty with this at bedtime. And, you know, it would have been just so hard for him.
What was his brother called?
His elder brother was Gudu.
Gudu.
And his younger brother was Kalu. And then, of course, he had also left behind his dear little sister, who was only about 3 years or less at the time.
And what also became clear is that his birth mother was almost definitely out there as well. How much time would you spend thinking about her?
A lot. Because, you know, in my quiet moments, and here I am with this darling little boy, and, you know, you can never forget for a moment, he had another mother, but she had lost her son and he was now with us. And, you know, her nightmare really, you know, it was something I couldn't forget.
And one thing that you would do is when you would go to bed at night, you would actually sort of speak to her. What would you do?
Well, it was so frustrating not being able to share all the wonderful moments and times. And, you know, the thing is that I really am very thankful. You know, I have had the pleasure of her little boy, and now, of course, he's a man, but she lost that. And I truly believed that it was an accident, you know, and that was confirmed as Saru told us more as he got older. So I knew she was there somewhere. I trusted she was still alive. So I just took to a little ritual, sharing the day, sending her good wishes and, you know, he's doing well at school and he had a good game of cricket, whatever he was doing, just all stuff that might be daily trivia, you know, trying to just put it out in the heavens, don't worry, he's well, he's safe.
And Saru had come from a family where he'd had siblings and obviously he'd then been in an orphanage surrounded by other children, and so you and your husband made the decision to adopt another child from India. Your son, Mantosh, when he arrived, had been subjected to a lot of abuse and neglect. How had that affected him?
Oh, well, of course, that was terrible because there are some things that children cannot recover from, and his story is particularly tragic. But at the end of the day, you know, we did our best, and he did his best too. And now he's 39. He's in reasonable health. He's got a lovely partner. He's working in our business with us. And so even though, of course, what happened in those early years will never leave him, between us as a family, we've enabled him to have the best life possible now.
And when Mantosh first came into your family, what impact did that have on you all?
Well, that was huge because he came when, in fact, we were at a stage in our family that we were very happy. We had our beautiful son Saru with us. We'd started a business. We were being successful in our work life, career life. We built a lovely home and so forth, and we were very comfortable. And then we thought, yes, we can offer another child a new future, and went through the process of getting approval and so forth. But of course, again, we had no way of knowing what our second child would bring to our family. And at times it was especially in the beginning, very plain to see that this was going to be a huge challenge for us as a family unit.
And having been so focused and determined to be a mother, and you had this very clear vision of what sort of mother you wanted to be, what impact did it have on you personally? I mean, sort of dealing with that.
Well, it had a huge impact on me in a couple of ways. When you're under a lot of stress for a long time, you can become quite fragile health-wise. And that is what happened to me. I developed a health condition and I became, I was very ill. I had a thyroid condition. And then, of course, I was suffering from a broken heart. I mean, I just felt so sad that I couldn't help my little boy. So there was that side to it. And the other part was the acknowledgement that, hey, we did not have the skills to remedy and to mend this little broken boy. And as he moved into adolescence, it became more evident that we were really struggling. And he finally left our home. And it was just so sad because there was absolutely nothing we could do. All we could do was say to ourselves that, hey, this happens in families. Some children do go in the wrong direction. And in a way, I thought back to when I was a young woman, I could have easily taken the wrong path too, through unhappiness and just with the circumstances that I was in.
Now, Mantosh had some incredibly difficult years, as you say, but by 2012, both of your sons were around 30 and they were both working with your husband at the family business. How was the family dynamic at that point?
Well, we were certainly more optimistic about Mantosh's future particularly, and also we were fully aware of the fact that when things were going well with him, we were all doing well and we were happy. So we just embraced our good times. Of course, then, you know, they were moving into their 30s. Saru decided to go to university to undertake some further study. And so that was the first time he'd been away from the family home. And I think in a way it was time for him to do that. And he got a different perspective. Suddenly he was amongst different people. And he had the opportunity to be amongst a lot of young Indian people who reawakened his identity, his sense of identity. And that was where he began his quest to search for his first family.
And let's talk about this in the way that it happened, because did you have any idea that Saru had, for the past 6 years, undertaken a secret project at night?
No, definitely not, because he was living with his girlfriend at the time. I mean, we had no idea that he was, you know, sitting in his lounge room there in front of a laptop, but he certainly did become obsessed with this quest.
Were there clues that he had maybe been up all night?
Looking back, yes, for the fact that he was always late for work was one, because he'd be up into the early hours of the night and then he'd stagger into work in the morning. He'd be so exhausted and stressed.
When did you find out? When did he tell you what he'd been doing?
Well, on a particular morning when he just came to work and went into John's office and said, "Hey, Dad, I've got something to tell you." And that was it. It was just like a sledgehammer out of the blue. He said, "I think I've found my first home. I've been searching all these years using this technology, this program called Google Earth, and I have found my home." And, of course, John was in shock. He sort of couldn't believe his ears. He thought, "What? You know, that this has been going on for so long."
And tell me what he'd been doing, because it really is mind-blowing, the amount of work he put into this. How exactly had he done it?
If you imagine, he'd worked out by questioning people how fast the trains went and how many kilometres they could go in a given time, because he was trying to put it back to the amount of time he recalled being on the train. So he virtually had drawn a circle, thinking that somewhere one of these train tracks is going to take me to where I came from. It was so methodical, And he was looking so closely at every detail for particular key indicators on the maps, the water tower, the dam, the fact that his station had three tracks going to it, which isn't very common. And he would cross off each station as he'd investigated it.
And when he identified these landmarks that he'd really been looking out for, how far away was the place he thought was his home to Calcutta, where he'd ended up?
It was thousands of kilometres away. His town was virtually right in the very middle of India, whereas, of course, Calcutta's on the east. So he was just absolutely astounded when he realised the distance he had actually travelled.
What also happened then is that you had kept these diaries. So when he was a little boy and he first come to live with you and he told you all of these things about his life, you then got out these diaries of the things that he told you. How did they compare to what he'd found?
They were spot on because, you know, we together drew little pictures and maps in quite a lot of detail, and he described to me where he'd come from, how he walked to this place and that.
And Saru made the decision to go to India, to go to this town and to try to find his old home. The day that he was supposed to be going to the place he thought might have been his home, I'm guessing you were just glued to your phone.
Oh, well, it was so stressful, you know, because really anything could have happened there. You know, he could have met with bad people. We felt there was a level of danger in this journey. Also, the fact that it may have been an incorrect place. But the first we heard was, in fact, by text. And it was in the night. We were both in bed. And then, of course, the ping went. And there was this message from Saru saying that he'd found his first family and they were as real as we are in Australia. And he'd finished off with, you know, how he loved us and we would always be his parents. Oh, it was just so exciting. And, of course, there was no sleep to be had after that. There was a lot of squealing and jumping up and down and so forth.
It is astonishing what happened.
I know. And really, you know, at the end of my life, just to have that incredible moment, you know, no one can take that from me.
Unfortunately, though, it wasn't all good news, because we've spoken about what Saru told you about the day he got lost as a child and that he'd actually been at the train station with his older brother, Gudu. What did he find out about what had happened to his brother?
Well, that was just such a sad bit of information, and he's told this by his mother, because he asks, "Where's Gudu?" And she said the words, "Gudu is no more," which is her way of saying that her son had died.
And it really does sound like it was utterly horrific, I mean, for her, because what transpired is that it was that very same day that Gudu was actually hit by a train.
This was just a most terrible shock for Saru. He just believed that Gudu would still be there and they could hug again and he could apologise for the situation, the predicament that he'd found himself in, and they would be reunited as brothers. But that was not to happen.
How long was it until you were also on a plane heading to India to meet his family?
It was around a year. It was to be in a documentary of this incredible event that had happened. Of course, I was very keen to meet Saru's first mother. It really was a bit of a miracle that this was happening.
So you headed out there, you had this documentary team in tow. Tell me about that moment when you and Saru met with his birth mother.
Well, again, it's one of the defining moments in my life. You know, I was so looking forward to this. I was so excited. But in a way, I was also, I guess, to be honest, a little bit frightened. Anyway, the morning came along. I was with Saru in this car with the journalist, and we drove in as far as we could. Then we had to walk the last distance because the road became very narrow and the car couldn't go any further. And for me, you know, holding Saru's hand, walking along that lane, that in itself was very precious because he'd played in that very lane as a little boy that I was now walking along. Until right ahead of us, we saw that Fatima was waiting there. It was almost like I was descending into some sort of out-of-body kind of experience, but, you know, we just walked on together, hand in hand, and within seconds we were there. And we just threw our arms around each other, and it seemed so natural and so right. You know, it's like we're from another planet, we two women, and yet here we are after more than 25 years holding Saru between us. You know, he's such a hulk of a person compared to us, and we're standing there in the dirt embracing each other. But really, in the end, I came to the meeting with this one thing that I really had to know, and that was, you know, because I knew she'd never given up on Saru returning. She'd said openly she was never going to leave that area because she believed he was coming back. But I wanted to know, did she feel any energy through the heavens that I was telling her he was safe and well and she would see him again one day? You know, all those things that I'd been saying to her at night. So the interpreter asked her these questions, and she listened closely, and straight away she spoke out very clearly and emphatically, "Yes, I always believed. I knew that he was okay. I knew he was coming home, and I could feel it, and I believed it." Well, of course, for me, the relief I felt was just huge. You know, I'd just longed to know that answer for so long that really I was quite overcome, and that's when I really started to cry. Sadly, though, it was interpreted by her as, was I thinking that I'm going to lose him? And she really was upset seeing me in such a state and started to try and wipe away my tears with her little hands, and she said something back to the interpreter to tell me, Saru is her son now, and I give her my son. This was like a gift. Oh, well, that really undid me further. I thought, what a woman.
And something that then happened is that you went into her home and you had brought with you a photo album. What was in the album and what was her reaction to it?
That was pretty amazing too. I'd put together in a package a bundle of photos of Saru growing up. So right from when he was very little, and then as he grew up in his school uniform, playing sport, graduating, special moments in his suit, looking good, then working in our business. And it was like a pictorial of his life. And it was so touching because she opened up the pages and looked at it and sort of had this little ritual of, you know, she kissed her fingers, touched the photo, and then put her hand to her heart. And she did this with each photo, like she's kissing this little boy growing up and putting him in her heart. It was pretty powerful stuff. I really was so happy. You know, that you couldn't have put a price on it.
Understandably, there was a huge amount of interest in Saru's story, and he ended up writing a book about it. And it wasn't long before this was picked up by film producers. Now, I loved reading about how you and Saru joked about who you wanted to play you.
Well, you know, we'd been through some pretty emotional and tough times. And I thought, well, look, this is happening. It sort of seems to be something that's bigger than us now, that we may as well embrace this process and enjoy it. We'd have a little laugh one evening over a meal, and we started talking about who should be the actor to play us. So It is a bit weird, but anyway, I've always been a Nicole Kidman fan. So straight away I said, oh, well, it's got to be Nicole. And, you know, Saru said, oh, in your dreams, Mum, you know, that won't happen. And I said, I don't care. I'm hanging out and I'm going to believe that it will happen. And it did. And I'm really glad that he didn't get his wish, though, because he wanted Wesley Snipes.
I love the sound of this conversation.
But I think we couldn't have had a better person to portray him because we love Dev Patel.
Because ultimately you did get your wish, and Nicole Kidman played you, Dev Patel played Saru, and they called the film Lion. I'm sure it's a name that many people listening are familiar with now. For you, though, seeing it on the big screen for the first time, you had this private viewing. What was that like?
To be quite honest, it was a shock. Mm. There's probably no way to put it. It was just such a huge shock to see on this huge screen these people pretending to be us, showing this story, which at times was so traumatic and difficult for us. And there it is in front of our noses. The other thing that was also very difficult was it was portraying a part of Saru's life that we weren't a part of, his first 5 years of life. We saw on the screen what his life would have been, the time on the train, the time in the foundling home, all of those things that he'd told us about, and here visually we're seeing them. And they are quite a large part of the film. It was very powerful. At the end of it all, we just sat there and we were really absolutely stunned. And we got up and we embraced each other. And the three of us just cried. We just couldn't help ourselves. I thought I can almost pass out. I really just couldn't talk. Cried for quite a while. And we were really very overwhelmed.
The film was then nominated for, what, 6 Oscars, I think it was. I mean, it was really very well received. And you ended up flying out to Los Angeles as a family for the Oscars ceremony. Was there a part of that whole process? I mean, the sort of glitz and the glamour, you know, that was quite fun?
So for us, we went and we were very optimistic. We were thinking, my goodness, you know, so many nominations, we would have been happy with one. So, of course, as it turned out, we didn't gain an Oscar at that time. But the part that I enjoyed equal to that event was, in fact, the world premiere of Lion. And that was where we were taken to New York. And there we are, walking the red carpet for the first time as a family with the actors prior to this film being shown publicly. It showed me that that part of the world was ready for this story. They were eager. They were happy to hear and see this story of an absolute miracle that had occurred in a young man's life. And so I was incredibly proud of that.
Obviously, Saru isn't your only son. For your other son, Mantosh, what has this experience been like?
For him, the film was very traumatic because he doesn't feel that his part in our family story was sensitively portrayed. But as I explained to him, he is part of our family. He is part of the story. He is part of our life. And that can't be taken away. So, you know, he had to come to terms with that, but I know it was a very difficult time for him.
And for you, what was it like to see Saru able to reunite with his family, but the same hasn't been able to happen for Mantosh?
No. Well, that's a very sad thing, of course. But, you know, I've never given up hope on that, just as I never gave up talking to Fatima through the heavens. You never know what life will give you next.
Having had such a difficult start yourself, do you feel proud of the family unit you've been able to create?
I do. I do because I'm sure I could not have tried harder. I couldn't have respected my role as a parent any more highly. And because it was so purposefully chosen, I'm living the life that in a way I did imagine and I did believe I could bring it about. And I'm very thankful that I can say that.
Sue Brierley speaking to me from her home in Hobart, Tasmania. She's written a book called Lioness. I'm Emily Webb, and I'll be back with another remarkable life story for you tomorrow, same time, same place. Bye for now.